For Women's History Month, from the Wings Archive.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today's program offers an Icelandic and a U.S. approach to electoral politics from a feminist perspective, as heard at the First World Summit on Women and the Many Dimensions of Power, June 1990, in Montreal, Quebec.
As a woman, I have no country. As a woman, I want no country. As a woman, my country is the whole world. Those well-known words of Virginia Woolf could well serve as a flying banner for this first World Summit on Women and the Many Dimensions of Power. We are here today, half a century after those words were spoken, to compare our experiences and formulate strategies which can bring women's voices the dimension of power.
Sigridur Duna Kristmundsdottir is a former member of parliament for the Icelandic Women's Alliance, a feminist party offering all women slates of candidates for political office. Her speech in Montreal was titled Time to Act.
On our guiding principle that as women, our experiences can be mutually meaningful, regardless of cultural variation, I shall present to you the method Icelandic women have adopted to act and change their world. That method is a model for acting towards a defined goal, the goal of obtaining political power for women to use according to their own gender-defined values and so change their world. And it is an activist model in the sense that it is grounded on the fundamental decision to act. Since the last quarter of the 19th century, Icelandic women have been engaged in organized women's rights activities. We got the right, the unconditional right to vote in 1915, that is 75 years ago. We have an early history of political participation by women's slates, and in the 1970s we had our liberationist period. By 1980, around 80% of Icelandic women, 80% of Icelandic women were working outside their homes, either part-time or full-time. Our wages were generally lower than those of men. And in spite of our high employment rate, we continued to be the ones responsible for housekeeping and parenting, and the problems we were facing often seemed insurmountable. Well, this is nothing unusual. I'm sure you know this from your own countries. These characteristics are not particular to Iceland. They are, with certain cultural modifications, applicable to women's social position in other parts of the world as well. And so is the method we adopted to deal with this situation. Instead of knocking on the doors of men, that is knocking on the doors of authority, asking men to do this for us or do that for us in their lawmaking and their policy making, we decided that we would try to enter into the domain of authority ourselves. By doing so, we fully utilized our decades-old right to vote and eligibility. We made ourselves visible and our voices heard in front of the loudspeakers and television cameras that operate excellently in politics. And we succeeded in having ourselves elected as policy and lawmakers. Of paramount importance in this respect is that we ran for election and got elected on the ideological grounds of our own women's values, derived from women's own life experiences. And we got elected to employ these values in our policy and lawmaking. Doing this was and is difficult. It did mean and does mean a lot of work, but it is possible, and that is the important thing. Besides, many of us have found it very enjoyable, a pleasure. In the first national elections we participated in 1983, we received 5.5% of the vote and three women elected into the 60-member Icelandic parliament. The next time around in 1987, we doubled our percentage of the vote and had 6 women elected into parliament. We are now the 3rd largest out of 7 political associations in Iceland. Next year, we have another election campaign coming, and the outcome of that will be decisive in terms of our government participation. In addition to our political work in Iceland, we have in the last few years been on the move, responding to the many requests from women's organizations in Europe and North America for speakers and information on the Icelandic women's slates. In several countries, women's slates are now being established, and such a slate in East Germany recently got 1 woman into the East German parliament. Political power entails first a position to change existing rules and regulations through law, either directly by succeeding in having our own proposals voted through parliament or municipal councils, or indirectly by exerting political pressure on a governing majority. Once you are in parliament, you can make a lot of noise, so in the end they will have to listen to you. Secondly, and even more importantly, political power entails what I shall call conceptual power. That is, power to influence how people think and the values they think by. Political power entails this by giving those who hold it platforms from which to speak and exert their influence, including access to the media, perhaps the most powerful channel of influence in our days. And it does so by legitimizing the voices that speak from those platforms. The dimension of political power thus holds the power of opinion making. It can influence and shape all areas of social life and our experience thereof, including the ethics, dominant ideologies, and traditions of a society. That is immensely important where women are concerned, because those are the social elements which are most resistant to change, and therefore they are the ones that most effectively block women's access to any kind of power. Conceptual power is therefore the dimension of power which in the long run is most effective in changing our world. Money, or economic power, is one of the key instruments in effecting the change we desire to see. Because, basically, if women are to create, they need not only a room of their own, they also need an income of their own. Money is an instrument usually not available to women as such, but an instrument political power can bring women, either directly through women's legislative efforts and national and municipal economic management, or indirectly through the employment of conceptual power, which can make others place this indispensable instrument at the disposal of women. Obtaining political power is therefore a means for women to obtain other dimensions of power. It does, of course, not exclude other approaches towards obtaining power any more than separate women's slates are the only means to obtain political power. But women's slates are, as has been established in Iceland, an effective way for women to obtain political power. As a model for acting, they allow women to form their political ideas freely and independently, liberate women from having to fight their way through male-determined political parties, and once on the platform, they allow women's voices to flow free, unrestricted if they dare, by male conventions, ethics, and ideologies. Obviously, women's slates cannot serve as an activist model in societies which do not hold elections, or where women do not have the formal right of vote and eligibility. Electoral systems which require a majority vote are less favorable in this respect than systems based on proportional representation. But we have to start somewhere. The women concerned have themselves to find their way in the creative activity which constitutes the establishing of a women's slate. Yet there are a few points I can give which might help. First, Women have to look at their own lives and social experiences, at their own gender-specific values for the ideas on which to base their slates. Otherwise, they are not likely to be able to give a new feminist dimension to their society's political spectrum. One immediately relevant to women in terms of their life experience and to which they as women can respond with their vote and with their active participation, which is equally important. Nor are women otherwise likely to be able to consistently and freely employ the political power in a manner meaningful for women's lives. Political power is not of any use to women generally unless the individual women who possess that power consistently employ it to change women's discriminatory situation. Otherwise, the conceptual power entailed in political power is not likely to bring about changes in those fundamentals of society which most effectively resist women's access to any dimension of power. In Iceland, we found it both enjoyable and not at all difficult to create a political ideology out of our own gender-determined values. Nor did it prove too hard to base on that ideology a policy on regional, national, and foreign affairs. Second, to go back to practical points. Each woman's slate as a model of activism must be constructed with regard to its particular social and cultural context. That is to say that women's slates should not attempt to be universally the same. Third, start small. Don't attempt to erect a national organization of women's slates right away. The success and durability of women's slates depends not least on how well rooted they are in women's reality, and therefore they have to be allowed time to grow out of that reality. In other words, start from the ground, not from above. Time is also needed to collect money, an indispensable instrument in any election campaign. At the same time, do not wait for too long. Timing is important and has to be figured out as you go along. Starting on the municipal level could be the first step, alliance with other municipal women's slates the next, and so on until a national organization is formed. Fourth and last practical point. When you get organized, don't fall into the trap of adopting uncritically a typically male hierarchical organization with chairman and the rest. Within such an organization, women's voices, except for a few, tend to become muted. In spite of its drawbacks in terms of allocation of responsibilities and fast work, decentralization is likely to produce better hearing conditions for all women's voices, which is, after all, what we aim at where society itself is concerned. The Icelandic women's slates do not have a chairman. We are organized into independent groups, and all positions of authority are regularly rotated. We make decisions by consensus, not by taking a vote, so that we can each time find out what unites us rather than what divides us. In case of conflict, a general meeting of the alliance, open to all women in the alliance, alone has the power to decide the issue. Practicing in your own organization what you wish to see for women generally is an essential part in the formation and employment of your political ideas. I said we know enough, and now is a time to act. We, the women of the world, have nothing to wait for. We have the knowledge and we have the experience we need. And if we don't do anything about our own situation, we cannot expect anybody else to do so. We have first and foremost to think in terms of women, in terms of women's lives, women's contingencies, women's concerns, women's values, and women's points of view. Everything else, including the dominant modes of thinking in terms of societies, institutions, economics, power, religion, etc., must come second. Only then can we, because we are women, begin to change our world. Thank you.
Sigridur Duna Krismann's daughter, speaking at the First World Summit on Women and the Many Dimensions of Power. On the same panel was Irene Natividad, president of the U.S. National Women's Political Caucus. Her speech was titled Political Power, Women's Hope, and Women's Challenge. Irene Natividad.
For me, politics is the most direct route to power, as my sister from Iceland so eloquently expounded. For those women who don't see a connection between politics and their daily lives, and you know that that's the majority of women, I contend that every aspect of our lives, from the amount of allowable preservatives in our food, to whether people could pray in schools, to our equal access to employment, is affected by some piece of legislation that is initiated, discussed, and voted on by a group made up predominantly of men, and in the United States, that is white men, at every level of government, from local to national. The only way we can impact on that legislative process is by choosing the legislator who best represents our interests, i.e., voting, or by becoming lawmakers ourselves. In the United States, the multipartisan women's political organization that I represent, the National Women's Political Caucus, decided 18 years ago that we can't just be sophisticated outsiders asking other people to legislate our interests. It's simply not enough to demonstrate, to lobby, or to march, no matter how large the parade. What we needed to do was to get inside under the government's skin, so we're not wringing our hands in the observers' galleries when the votes are being counted. Where we want to be is not just in the halls of power lobbying, but on the floor of Congress, the state legislature, or the city council, casting votes for pieces of legislation we may have initiated ourselves. For the women's movement in politics, forming a political advocacy group for women was a necessary step. For too long, American women had suffered whisker burns from the lip service both parties had paid to the sharing of power. We had to remind ourselves one more time that no one ever gives away power. We have got to grab it for ourselves. So we started by building a political pipeline, by recruiting, training, and supporting feminist women to run for office, but especially at the grassroots level. Well, how are we doing? Our progress is similar to a pyramid, with our greatest successes right now being at the lower levels of public office. In 1971, when the caucus first began, there were 362 women state legislators. Those are the lawmaking bodies in each state. Now, there are 1,262 women state legislators, or 17% of the total number in the country. In 1971, we only had 7 women mayors of major cities. We now have 112. And that includes cities like San Diego, the 5th largest city in the United States, Houston, the 4th largest city in the United States, and in fact, the state of Texas has 10 of its major cities headed by women, and in fact, that state might soon have a woman governor in Ann Richards, the one who said that George Bush had a silver foot in his mouth. Now, if one were to go down to the lower levels of offices, the municipal level, one would find about 16,000 women holding such positions. Now, while these numbers may show some progress, I have to admit that when you look up at the federal level offices, the picture is bleak. 2 women senators out of 100 is not equal representation. 27 congresswomen out of 435 is not equal representation. Neither are 3 women governors out of 50. It is clear that in the United States, people power, which we have because women are the majority of the population, has yet to be transformed into proportional political power. There are still people around who believe that, as one woman governor said so well, that there's a permanent dichotomy between being female and being in charge. In 1987, opposed to wringing our hands and bemoaning that fact, the National Women's Political Caucus decided to take a look at those biases, and we commissioned a national survey of 1,500 voters, male and female, to find out about their feelings, their attitudes towards women candidates. I want to share some of those findings with you since you may find similar parallels in your country. First, we found that women voters tended to favor women candidates in larger percentages than male voters. Although overall, voters of both sexes expressed greater support for women candidates. The exception to this were Southern women, older women, and rural residents of both sexes, all of these groups being far more conservative. Secondly, the support for women candidates decreased the higher the level of office. In other words, more voters would support women for the school board, but not the presidency. And that is not surprising, given the fact that in American history, not many women have held high levels of offices. Thirdly, and here's where we come to the stereotype of the woman candidate, women candidates were perceived as good managers or administrators, as a source of new ideas, as able to see the human side of issues, as honest, and finally, as better able to curb government spending. Now, this last one was a surprise to us, but then again, why should it be? Guess who handles the family purse? Fourthly, male candidates, on the other hand, were seen as good in times of crises, as tough decision makers. We should tell that to the guys at Meech Lake. As able to handle larger budgets and the rigors of travel that come with being an office holder. And lastly, in terms of issue competencies, men were seen as better able to handle foreign affairs, trade, national budget, defense, while women were perceived as able to handle domestic issues better, education, environment, childcare, and so on. On the whole, these findings showed not only some progress in the attitude of the electorate, but that these may be propitious times for American women candidates, given the easing of East-West tensions. Being seen as an expert or advocate for domestic issues is an advantage. In addition, integrity and creativity, as many of you know, are currently in short supply in U.S. politics. So the stereotype of women candidate which emerged in this poll may be a plus rather than a minus. Now, one of the questions which received a lot of press attention in this survey that we posed to the voter was this. Do you think a woman would do as well as, worse, or better than a man in the office of president? 57% of American voters, male and female, believe that a woman would do as well as or better than a man as president. 31% said that a woman wouldn't do as well, and 12% were undecided. We were very encouraged by these results. 4 years earlier, we had posed a similar question, and 60% of the voters didn't think a woman would do as well in the office of the presidency. So we released the poll, and it received an enormous amount of attention, about 4 inches worth of news clips, 36 editorials in favor of having more women in office. What we found discouraging, however, were some of the headlines that accompanied these news stories. In the Athens, Ohio Messenger, we read this headline: many voters oppose woman in Oval Office. I thought, which poll was this? In a Hawaii newspaper called The Garden Island, we discovered this headline, which you will love. It said, "Not yet, girls." In the Brookhaven, Mississippi Daily Ledger, we found, quote, "Nearly a third oppose idea of woman president," which begs the question, what happened to the two-thirds? And my favorite, from a North Carolina paper, the Raleigh News and Observer, quote, "White House, no place for ladies." Now, there were some positive headlines. The Washington Post, a respected paper, I must tell you, was typical. Most voters say female candidates as capable as men. For the most part, the headlines did split evenly between positive and negative. I remind you, however, that the survey data that ran with all of these stories was precisely the same. Only the headlines change, either reflecting the bias of the paper, the readers, or the headline writer. I have since discovered that 99.9% of all headline writers are men. Now, I share this aspect of the survey release with you to underscore what we have been talking about these past 4 days, and that is the power of the media to affect the women's fight, the women's movement fight for political equity. So, what did we do in the National Women's Political Caucus with this survey outside of releasing it to the general public and hoping to affect public opinion in the process? Well, first, the survey provided us with a base poll that we then gave to women candidates so that they could use it in formulating their own poll. Many of you probably don't know this, but polling is very expensive in the United States, and creating the polling instrument is another source of expense. Secondly, we learned that targeting women voters in a district was critical in forming an electoral base for women candidates. Third, since support was higher for women candidates running for local office, and since most of our congresswomen were former state legislators, we developed a training program specifically for women running for state legislative seats. Fourth, since all population projections show that minorities will be the majority in the United States by the year 2000, we established a campaign training program for women of color candidates, which tried to address the special difficulties we face when running for public office. Fifth, since the media plays such a major role in campaigns, we developed new training in media techniques for local women candidates who normally would not be able to afford such training. How to handle press conferences, how to look, how to be media savvy, how to handle debates, and so on. And lastly, given our own press experience with this survey, I started a journalism awards program to be given for excellence in coverage of women in politics, and I call it the Emmas. This year, I am proud to say that over 150 entries from reporters all around the country were submitted. Most of the reporters, by the way, are women. What I have given you is a small window on the unsexy, nitty-gritty grunt work of what it takes to move a movement. It is what it takes to create political power in the United States. Most of it is not fun. The fun comes when the woman wins. The fun comes when the woman wins and actually passes a bill that affects the thousands of lives of women in our country. However, I must admit that the day when half of our nation's governors are women is a long ways away. Our effort is a little bit like trying to carve a woman's face on Mount Rushmore, that mountain that celebrates four male presidents. It'll take years to chip away at stubborn rock before a woman's face begins to emerge, but trust me, emerge it will. We are patient, we are persevering. There are more of us, and we live longer. Thank you.
Irene Natividad of the U.S. National Women's Political Caucus and Sigridur Duna Kristmundsdottir of Iceland's Feminist Party were among the speakers at the First World Summit on Women and Political Power convened in Montreal, June 1990, by FRAP, Women for Access to Political and Economic Power. Their talks were recorded by Catherine Davenport and edited for distribution by WINGS.
For information about WINGS archives, email wings@wings.org. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.